Greetings, Earthlings. This is Robert J., and I'm too lazy to type what I think. Not too lazy to flap my gums a bit. Never know what's gonna come out, so humor me and stick around for a while. What's the worst that could happen? You might even enjoy yourself. Okay, here we are. I think things seem to be recording this time. And this is Too Lazy to Type What I Think, the Ticking Artist edition. And we have a ticking artist whose face is on my computer screen as we speak. And I'm speaking with singer-songwriter, bartender extraordinaire, real estate mogul, and Daphne Parker Powell. I almost forgot to say your name. And we've back on the in the days of the Robert J. program, we used to play her music under the name of Daphne Lee Martin. So if you have any of her tracks, listen to them. And be prepared for what she's got coming out. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about how her life as an artist has been impacted by this COVID, and her personal life as she chooses to talk about, and real estate. And never did get to see you in Connecticut at your bar. So maybe we'll hoist one together in Nolens. How you doing, Daphne?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me again.
I know. We've done this quite a few times. We used to, for those not in the know, when I was doing a radio program called the Robert J. Program, Daphne, I think, was the most interviewed person. She was my most interviewed person on the show. And I appreciated it because it's nice to have the artists that you are playing actually come on and talk to you. And you were always a fun one. And we saw each other, what, a couple of years, 3 years ago, before pre-pandemic in Seattle. Yeah. And so.
Yeah. A couple times coming through on tour as well.
That's right. So what the heck is going on? You've changed you've changed locations. And so you're no longer in New London, Connecticut. And now you are.
I am in New Orleans, Louisiana. Not exclusively, though. I am still back in New London some of the time.
So she's a new person. New London, New Orleans, maybe
we'll
next.
We'll call it bi-coastal.
Bi-coastal, new. Yeah, well, that's true. That is a coast down there. You don't think about that as bi-coastal. It's the Gulf.
I consider the United States to be four coasts, really. Four. The Great Lakes are their own thing as well.
Well, that's true. That's true. You never think about lakes as coasts, but yeah, it doesn't matter. Yeah. And so we got the Pacific, Atlantic, and the Gulf. Okay. So have you gotten tired of New Orleans food yet?
Oh, man. I think I could live 14 lifetimes and not even visit all the restaurants. Oh, right. A little tired of everything.
Yeah, that's true. So have you?
I'm doing that magic trick that they all say that as soon as you move to New Orleans, you gain 10 pounds.
Yeah.
I'm just making sure that's true, and it is.
So just for clinical purposes only, right?
You know, one wants to test the waters.
So okay, so what's your favorite? Is there anything you've tried that you'd never tried before so far?
Well, not that I haven't tried before. I've always been pretty adventurous when it comes to food. But I have had some fantastic, wonderful meals. I got to, apologies to all the vegans out there, but they know how to do meat down here. Holy barbecue. It's just incredible. And the seafood's pretty good, too.
Yeah. My wife developed a seafood allergy while she was living on the Gulf.
Oh, no.
She got so sick, just about had to go to the hospital, and the doctor said, well, looks like you can't eat this stuff anymore. And so no shellfish.
So that's wild.
Yeah. Well, I know, cause that's so big a part of what's going on or what goes on down there. So how long have you been there now? Exactly. When was it you got down there?
Well, I got here just a couple of days after Christmas, so I've been here a couple of months now.
Okay, and yeah. So is it, were you down there visiting and whatnot and found a neighborhood, or how did you come upon this place you're in now?
Well, I've been traveling down to New Orleans. The first time I came here, I was actually like just a kid in college at the time. I was sailing on traditional wooden sailing vessels, and for op sail in 2000, I was aboard the Pride of Baltimore II, and we actually sailed all the way up the Mississippi River, which is about 100 miles from the Gulf, to get into the city of New Orleans. Sailed up into the city, and I was, in 2000, I would have been 20 years old. And I completely fell in love with the city then. And I've been traveling back here every opportunity that I get. Yeah, I'm 41 now, so for 21 years, I've been coming back And I've had a couple of bandmates from here that have toured with me on the road. And I just, every time, the place just got, you know, deeper roots in my heart until it just kind of took over. I just wanted to be here, so.
Well, I remember back to, I don't know if that was your first album, it was the first time I was aware of you was with the Raise the Rent band. And that, to me, had a sound that could have come out of New Orleans. Some of the songs had that kind of vibe to it for me, anyway.
Yeah. And a little swanky Western swing thing.
Yeah. Oh, I still listen to Nostradamus.
Oh, nice.
That's still my favorite of off of that album.
Did we ever talk about where that song came from?
You know, if we did, it probably bears repeating. Where'd that song come from?
Nostradamus was a really fun writing exercise, actually. What happened at the, you mentioned my bar in the intro. So for a very long time, I've bartended at a little tiny tavern from the 1790s called the Dutch Tavern in New London, Connecticut. Now, this place is just a little hole in the wall. It's in, you know, the basement of a very old building in the middle of downtown New London, and all it does is serve beer and wine, and it's this little, it's kind of crusty, really. It's just so ancient, and it's got you know, all the old wood shellacked walls, so everything looks just kind of like it's been through a fire. It's a wild looking place, but it's got a vibe to it. Eugene O'Neill grew up in New London, Connecticut, and he used to sit in there and write. So when you read a play like The Iceman Cometh, you find yourself like sitting at a table in the Dutch, you know, it's just, you can't really separate those two. So we were a bunch of us, the Dutch has always been an artist haunt, you know, a little place where all of the beer is cheap and, you know, everyone just kind of congregates there to talk about and to make art. And at one point, I was sitting around with a bunch of friends at the Dutch, and we did what was called an exquisite corpse, which is a Victorian parlor game. Back before people had TVs to numb their brains out, people would actually, you know, play word games with each other and stuff. The Victorian, you know, tradition of the exquisite corpse was you would write a line of poetry or whatever was on your mind, and then you would pass the piece of paper to the next person. And then they would write down something and fold the paper over to cover up what you had written and then pass it to the next person and so on, so that each person could only see the line immediately before what they were writing. And then after the paper has made it all the way around the room, you unroll this now scroll of paper and read it in succession. So it's kind of like a giant game of telegraph.
Mm-hmm.
And that is Nostradamus.
Wow.
Exactly how that song was written. So that's a number of friends of mine.
Wow. So that's, now I have to go back and really study out the words and go, that's bizarre.
It took a little Ouija board, you know? a little fixing at the end. But yeah, it was pretty much pretty close to straight up how it played out in the bar that night. It's pretty great.
Well, so if we go, because my wife and I want to go to New England. She lived as a little tiny girl in New Hampshire. And so mm-hmm. we want to, you know, fly into Boston and go and part of the trip was always going to be we were going to stop in and buy a beer from you. But if I go in and drop your name, will they be nice to me?
Oh, my goodness. They probably won't let you pay for anything. And if we plan it right, I'll be back visiting myself, and maybe they'll let me pinch hit a shift.
Because I figure I could pull up my phone and find the little selfie that we have together or something and go, see?
Now those
I'm not just name dropping. I really know her. So tell me or tell us how you've come out the other end of this, you know, kind of pestilence that we've all kind of experienced.
Yeah, COVID's been such a strange and wild journey. Obviously, for all of us touring musicians, it just squashed all of our plans. I had had, you know, a run to South by Southwest, a pretty big, you know, Southeast U.S. tour booked, and then a bunch of studio time to make my new album, The Starter Wife, in Kentucky in, you know, March of 2020. And none of that panned out. And it only panned out, like, you know, maybe two weeks before we were ready to leave was when we had to finally pull the plug and cancel. It was such a bummer. So everything got put on hold. Plane tickets and, you know, hotels and everything just got squashed. We ended up, instead of doing what we really hoped for to be like a really Laurel Canyon-y vibe, making the record, you know, where we get everybody in the room and there's like tapestries on the walls and, you know, everyone is just kind of like, you know, grooving on each other and smoking and talking and being like cool with everybody. And that was what I wanted. I wanted that like cohesion of live performance for this album. None of that is even possible. None of that has been possible ever since. So what we've ended up having to do is kind of pivot, and, you know, everybody's emailing parts in and doing the best that they can to connect with each other online and phone calls and, you know, FaceTime and Zoom, whatever we can do to figure out how to stay, you know, as connected to each other as we wanted to be if we were live in a room. So it's taken a lot longer to make this record than we hoped, just because everything is limited by the amount of technology each person has at their fingertips at their own home, or, you know, the time that they have available. A lot of folks lost work and were scrambling to just make a living, you know, during this time. So it's been wild trying to put it all together.
I was pretty fortunate because I continued to receive a paycheck as a employee of the school, and we did school for a while online, and then we came back, and we're still not back to normal. We, you know, and the school I work at is for special needs young adults, 18 to 21, and we help them learn how to develop job skills and take them to job sites, and I function as a job coach, but it's been a while since, you know, until we were able to actually do that again. So it was kind of like,
sure,
we couldn't be who we were. So is there anything you can look at and say, well, you know, this good thing happened because of COVID and it wouldn't have happened without it? Is there anything there?
Well, I ended up with, I've always been a big, just, my creativity isn't limited to writing songs. I'll say that. I've always been a big crafter and I like working with my hands. So one of the things that happened when all of this hit was I realized that massive shortage of any kind of personal protective equipment and things like that. And I ended up just busting out my sewing machine. I made about 1,000 masks by hand.
Wow.
Yeah, right out of the gate. And I ended up being able to donate to a bunch of nonprofits. So I ended up getting involved with people that I wouldn't have ordinarily been around.
Mm-hmm.
I got a lot more just intrinsically tied to parts of my community that I had not up to that point really had a chance to connect with. And it was a really incredible experience to kind of buckle down and think locally in a way that I hadn't in a long time. And to exercise that sort of homemaking maternal skill that, you know, my artist life doesn't make much time for. So,
well, that's,
you know,
yeah,
I remember to do that.
Yeah, I remember talking about the masks. You were making the masks the last time we talked. That's nearly 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Not quite two, but nearly two. I was looking on the list of podcasts that are published, and so that was, yeah, it was back there, and I was still. So not only did I do that, I was still able to deliver Uber Eats all that time.
And
there, so
you go.
It didn't impact me as badly as most people that I know, and or people, you know, people in service industries and restaurants and bars and musicians. Shortly before, the last trip we made before it hit, we were in Southern California, and we went for the first time to the Whiskey A Go-Go.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw, and they were having a big, it's kind of a fundraiser sort of thing, because this law went into effect in California where bars have to treat anybody that plays music there as an employee and do the whole employee tax thing and all of that. And they were kind of trying to fight that. And I don't know where the fight has gone, because it kind of, everything just went in the crapper after that. So I'm not really sure. We're going to be seeing somebody down there that's familiar with all of that. And so I'm going to find out from him, who's he's a writer for a bunch of Hollywood stuff. And so we'll see.
Nice.
And that's really cool. So what can you share with us about the starter wife?
Well, at this point, I think we have gotten our collective poop in a group, and pretty much all of the parts are in now. We're just waiting on a couple more things. We've got one song that we're still working on a good bit, but pretty much everything else is in the can at this point, and we're going to launch into mixing imminently here. I'm hoping to actually go up into Kentucky to work with Dwayne Lundy at the Lexington Recording Company in person to do some mixing here. We're aiming at this moment to release in September, probably early end of September. And we're going to do digital. We're going to do, you know, limited run of CDs, and we're going to do vinyl for this one as well. So I'm very excited. I'm hoping, again, starting conversations with Team Claremont. So hoping to be able to work with a fantastic PR agency again, and just really excited. I hope, beyond hope, that by September, when this thing comes out, that I'll be able to tour properly and come see everybody, because
well, yeah.
I miss it so desperately. And I just really want to get back out on the road again with this new record.
Well, and you know, I might be wrong, but it seems like you're now in a city that has a lot of venues that lend itself to just, I don't know, the romantic notions that we have of the early 60s, and, you know, like the folky places in New York and all of those clubs that are still around that famous people, you know, got famous at. And it seems like there's a whole lot of places in New Orleans that nurture live music more so than a lot of other places. Is that, am I close?
Yeah, no, that's very much the case. I mean, in New Orleans, again, I've just moved here, so I'm still piecing it together. It's a little bit like a puzzle, and there's still some gaps. I'm not exactly sure where everything fits together, but, you know, a lot of folks come to New Orleans and their only experience is with Bourbon Street.
Right, that's pretty
sleazy.
And that's
primarily cover bands. You know, yes. that's a lot of funk, a lot of soul, a lot of cover bands, a lot of really good crowd pleasing music,
right.
But not a lot of original singer songwriter type stuff. Not a lot of, you know, writers and composers really getting to feature their work down there. But that's not what this city is. That is
right.
One street in
right.
An enormous city full of incredible resources. And there's all of these places that are a little further off the beaten path that are just, you know, absolutely nurturing up an incredible scene of poets, of writers, of storytellers, of comics, you know, of burlesque dancers, of songwriters, just every flavor of culture that you can imagine. And it's such an open-minded you know, it's just a beautiful, diverse, queer, amazing city, and everyone has a voice here. I'm so inspired by it. I mean, little neighborhoods like out in Carrollton, you get the Oak Street neighborhood, or, you know, kind of in the middle of the city, you get Ferret. You know, there's all of these beautiful places in the Bywater that people don't know if they're not from here. But they're definitely nurturing up that smaller, you know, developing scene.
And I have a, you know, I have pictures in my mind of little blues joints and stuff, and, you know, guys in a guitar, you know, kind of a latter-day Robert Johnson guys. And then you go a little bit west and you hit into the Cajun country, and that's got its own world of music and art and creativity that's only semi-tapped, it seems.
I feel like that stuff is sort of the thing that you wait for an invitation to join.
Yeah.
I could be wrong. I would welcome an invitation if anybody would like to make one. But I would love to learn more about that style of music and that community. It seems, again, like it's off the beaten path. And so unless you have a reason to be there, you don't find out as much about it as you want.
Of somewhere like Lafayette that, you know, people know about it. It's not out in the bio so much, but it's a college town too, right? And so you take places that are in the middle of conservative, socially conservative states and parts of the country, yet you throw in thousands of college students, and it's just a really interesting mix. You know, like Austin is mm-hmm. a place I see like that, and the college towns really seem to make it easier for an artist to go and be an artist.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, what else were we going to talk about? Now I've lost my train of thought. The title of The Starter Wife to me is intriguing. Is there a tellable story about that?
Sure. I mean, it's literally the only snarky thing about the album. You know, I went through a really devastating, complicated, and painful divorce. I thought that my life was figured out. It's hard to describe unless you've experienced it yourself, how it is to love someone in a way that you really don't imagine. You can't imagine your life without them, that you're that devoted, that you're that, you know, entirely committed. And then to have that ripped out from under you, it crumbles the foundation of who you think you are. It changes everything. You no longer have a compass. And so when that happened, which is now 5 years ago almost for me, so I've recentered my gravity at this point, but you know, it was really hard to cope with the anger and the frustration and the feeling of being lost in all of that. And so, you know, that questioning of my self-worth, my reality and my position, you know, relative to everything, my sort of kinesthetic, you know, acceptance of my place in the world, was really so challenged at that time. And, you know, being able to look at it almost through a humorous lens with a title like The Starter Wife, because I was living in Connecticut, which is one of the wealthiest and, you know, most, you know, blatantly materialistic sorts of places in the country. And, you know, you'll hear, especially I was working in real estate, you hear this word, you know, starter house or starter mansion, you know, a lot. And I just kept thinking to myself, like, was I just practice? was I the thing that you, like, you get because it's the thing that you're supposed to get, and then you get bored of it, you get tired of it, you throw it away, you move on past it. And so that's, you know, that was where I just sort of drew the line. I was like, if I make light of this, if I find a way to find humor in this, then I get to relieve myself of the burden of it in a way. Well, and then nothing on the album itself is snarky at all. Everything on the album is really beautiful and introspective and poetic and just raw and honest. And so it's sort of in itself a radical act.
Well, I think that's really cool. And if you can look at those kind of events with some, you know, in hindsight with some humor and not let it embitter you forever. You know, I'm sure there's got to be some bitterness that was there for a while, but, and I don't know, I had a pastor once tell us that unforgiveness is like drinking poison expecting it to hurt the other person, and bitterness is the same thing. It's you know, you're the one that's bitter and the other person's gone on and they're having a good old time and you're still being bitter. And if you can find a way to be happy, easy for me to say, but, you know, and see the good stuff. I mean, it brought you, you wouldn't be in New Orleans probably, right?
It's true. I mean, I built a really beautiful life in New London and I have an incredible community there. But it was also, in a way, a sort of root-bound situation, and I'm grateful for the freedom. You know, I'm grateful for the opportunity to be able to chase dreams. I would not have the opportunities to do music in New London that I have here, and I'm excited to see how that shakes out. And I will always have that community. You know, that is still my family.
Well, and, you know, in New London, you'd probably never have a chance to have the Neville brothers as your backup singers or something.
That is true. Oh, my God, what a dream come true that would be.
we'll have the Meters on this track, and we'll get Ivan Neville over here. And
you know, I actually did go to see the Squirrel Nut Zippers at the Howlin' Wolf.
Yeah.
Leslie Cooper introduced them. It was fantastic. It was like so many heroes on the stage all at the same time. But it was amazing to watch them live. I had never seen them. I'd seen Jimbo play with Andrew Bird at a Newport Folk Festival. So that was fantastic. But just to be able to stand 4 feet away from just people that I just musically respect so much, and to realize I live in a place now where I can do that every night of the week. Then I was walking down Frenchman Street the other day. I had gotten my hair cut a couple of blocks away and the parade was on its way. So I was like, oh, I'll stick around and watch some of the parade. I heard a violin and I immediately recognized the tone of the violin. I didn't have to see the bill. I didn't have to see the person. I could tell by the sound of the tone of the instrument itself who was playing, and I just spun around the corner and ducked in, and of course it was Dr. Sick. It was like, you know, I'm so delighted to be in a place where that is my day-to-day reality. I'm so thrilled with it, and I can't wait to add my voice to that collection. Right now I'm still in, you know, making friends and observing kind of mode, but I'm so excited to be part of this.
You're like Dorothy, and you've only just dropped the house on the witch, and now you gotta.
That's right.
Now it's time to make your way.
I'm starting to meet friends. Yeah.
Well, it's exciting, and I'm excited to, you know, for September to get here to hear what's coming. Is there a style that you would say goes with this, or is it pretty much you don't have? Since you're not tied to a record company, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah. There's basically one record company that I think that I would be really thrilled to work with, and I don't even want to say their name because I don't want to jinx it.
Right.
But Tom Waits is on their label.
Okay.
I'll say that much.
Oh, there's another backup singer for you.
I know, right? With a fascination for New Orleans.
Yeah.
But no, I like being an entrepreneur. I like having creative agency. I like being able to, you know, do what I dream and see it to be true, and to give that same creative license to the people that I collaborate with without any kind of, you know, suit telling me what to do about it.
Well, exactly. And it just seems like there are so many artists and musicians I guess you could be a musician without being an artist. You could be a technician, but and I guess we need them too in the studios and whatnot. But there's people that make an album, and the label won't let them diversify. You need to play this style. You need to play this. You need to play that. I'm thinking of somebody like a Beth Hart, who will not say, you know, she's not going to just play blues. She's not going to just do, you know, she's all over the map with her albums, and I love it. And yeah. You mentioned Tom Waits, and I'm just thinking about the last thing he recorded where he's got Keith Richards on it with him. I would love to have been in that session just to drink beer with him.
Absolutely. And, you know, being able to have the creative freedom to just do what you feel inspired to do is pretty extraordinary. Whether the financial backing trade-off is worth it is up to each artist,
right?
You know, and their relationship with the company. But yeah, I definitely enjoy the freedom.
Well, I guess if you're happy with what you're doing, as long as you're able to pay your bills and keep a roof over your head, you don't have to live in the, you know, under the shell of your pickup. If you're not getting mega rich, I guess it's okay. Yeah,
Yeah, well, I mean, if you talk with artists that are, you know, that are working with labels, that are working, you know, even people that are filling theaters, like it's really tough to make a living doing this. Even when you're, you know, a notch, two notches, three notches up from where I'm at right now, it's still incredibly difficult to make any kind of passable living, you know, doing music exclusively. And a lot of that has to do with just how bizarrely the industry treats it. You know, everyone is up in arms about Spotify right now, and rightfully so, not just because of the controversy of what content goes up on Spotify, but also largely because of the way that they treat their artists. You know, and people are jumping ship. I, you know, personally conflicted about that, but I feel like, you know, people think that music should be free, so they treat it that way.
Yeah. And I think that the artists that are going to jump ship should be jumping ship because of their financial, you know, lack from, you know, as opposed to, well, I don't like what this guy says, and so he's a jerk. And I hold the people that listen to those guys responsible for their own actions, you know, and so I don't like to see them say, you know, well, sorry, we don't like what you're saying, so you no longer have a platform. And yeah, at some point, the other side's going to be in charge and they're going to come for what I say. And so,
it's really difficult to police one system and not all of the systems.
Right.
You know, everyone is still going to leave their music on YouTube, and everyone is still going to leave their music in all of these other places where, you know, similarly difficult situations exist. And I understand the groundswell movement of, you know, jumping ship and making a case for it.
Right.
And say, you know, if we all, you know, join our voices together, we can affect really lasting positive change. I absolutely understand that. But I think it's going to take a really comprehensive movement like that to change the music industry in a way that will long-term benefit the creators, the people like me that are writing the songs, that are, you know.
It seems like once upon a time, it wasn't perfect, but we all listened to our music for, you know, for free, I say with air quotes, on the radio.
Yeah,
but your stuff had to get on the radio for that to happen, and so there was a lot of hoops to be jumped through and heinies to kiss for that, and so that wasn't perfect, and so I don't know, there probably isn't anything perfect. I think the best thing right now is that all the artists have a lot more at their disposal to make their art. You can do it in your house. You know, you can put up some, you know, you can put up some stuff in a room and just go and record it. You don't have to have a fancy recording studio that you're paying however many dollars an hour to use. And so it's sort of like, if you're good, people will start to hear you and see you, and, you know, I don't know how YouTube works in terms of an artist going on there. I know a few people that are doing live streams, and they started doing them during the pandemic. David Wax Museum. Are you familiar with him?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And he and his wife are you know, every week they were doing a thing. They were doing something up in their attic, and they just did a fundraiser and built a barn right now. Or they took a barn and turned it into a little studio show place, and that's pretty cool. And they're, you know, kind of a eclectic and eccentric kind of band with the music that they play. And I like that. It reminds me of the 60s.
Yeah, they're amazing.
So there's people that took that and they're running with it. And, you know, I don't know how wealthy they're going to get. And they're not going to, I don't think they're going to be the next Beatlemania or anything like that. But, you know.
But think about it, Robert. Like, you're doing a podcast right now.
Exactly.
You're a creator, too. And you're out there helping, you know, share good music that you love with other people, too. And that's, to me, that's what it's all about, you know.
Well, I always dig turning people on to music that they haven't heard before. And that's what I liked to try to do with the radio show. It just got to be where I couldn't justify the time I had to put in for not, you know. I quit doing it essentially when I started driving for Uber. Because that was kind of like money here and now, as opposed to, okay, I got to spend all this time instead of driving. I got to, you know, research, prepare, do this, find this song, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe 30 people were listening. And it's like, oh, it was fun. And then, you know, if money were no object, I live about 3 blocks from a community college here, and they have a radio station. And that was my first major out of high school. Was radio broadcasting, and then I made a left turn and you know, wound up at full circle doing the online radio. But I always thought about, guy, after I retire, if I can ever retire, after I retire, I can I'll walk down the street and say, hey, let me do a show. And now there's this modern music and a lot of hardcore, you know, and stuff. But I said, let me do a show that shows you the history of where your stuff came from. I think that's kind of a cool thing, kind of a Little Steven sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Underground garage. I call it the underground carport.
Nice. And there's so much stuff online now, too. So many incredible radio stations that you can tune into just on the internet. It's really delightful. Like, you can find so many great niche things. Whatever your tastes are or whatever you want to explore, it's out there for you now. You know, you can find it.
And so now, okay, so you're in this world, and you're a singer-songwriter and other things. I mean, you're not just a singer-songwriter, but you're that's your art. That's the art that
that's the defining characteristic. Yes.
Right. But what else do you see yourself doing where you could just say, okay, now I can just do my art and I can live off of it? As opposed, you know, not necessarily going on a whirlwind tour with somebody all over the, you know, but merch and this and that and, you know, fair pay from streaming services and what would make it doable?
Oh man, if you were
the queen of the world.
Well,
and that's just assuming that you're not, but let's say
a lot of things would change. I'll tell you that. I guess one of the things that I've always felt really challenged by was having to work day jobs where I did not feel like I was bettering anyone's lives, if that makes sense.
Right.
And I feel like that has become increasingly true. Bartending is fun because it's almost like playing a gig. You know, people work hard. They want to come out. They want to decompress. They want to feel good, right? They want to, you know, feel their feelings. They want to be themselves because they haven't been able to do that all week at work, right? And so whether you're bartending or whether you're, you know, up on stage singing your heart out to these folks, like, you know, you're helping them be themselves, helping them find comfort, helping them relax, helping them enjoy their lives, right? Not their jobs. And for most people, unfortunately, that's kind of their situation, right? They have to work in a job where they're not waking up, jumping out of bed in the morning, psyched to go do it because they have to do it. It's their job. And it's, if I were the queen of the world, I would, everyone would be doing what they want, what they could jump out of bed doing, whether it was money making or not. For me, that would be singing songs for people, you know? If I had to monetize one more art form, I've actually gotten really into painting, weirdly, especially watercolors. And so if I were able to devote all of my attention to art, not queen of the world or anything, but right, just monetizing another art form in order to make ends meet, I'd probably go with the visual art side and crafting and painting.
It's funny, I actually started doing a little bit of watercolor last year when we were doing online school, because one thing that we did every day was an hour of art stuff, and we found this website or YouTube thing where this guy did it. It was for kids, you know, but most of our students, it suits them. And when I was in college and high school, I used to do acrylic painting, and so
nice.
The watercolor, I just never got a feel for it. But this time I started doing some stuff. Oh, that's not, you know, that's fun. And I was surprised, because all this stuff on social media and the stuff on the election and all this crap, and that was just totally stressing me out and making me feel like not happy. But I do this and I was able to tune it all out, and it was really nice. It was really, you know, but it was something I quit doing before just because it was a time and responsibility thing.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is everybody has to sacrifice the stuff that feeds their soul
to feed their bodies
in order to put food on the table. It's such a bummer how that works.
If I could just let my body get a little smaller and my soul get a little bigger, that would be that'd be perfect, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So what about like singing bartender?
There we go.
Does anybody do that?
I live in New Orleans now, and if there is one place on earth where that could be the case, I'm guessing it's here.
Because wouldn't that be, it'd be just like watching a movie where the lady behind the bar is singing, you know, and as she sings, she takes and slings that mug down the, like they always show, it goes zing down the
slides
bar.
Perfectly. Never spill.
Yeah. And the foam kind of jiggles a little bit at the end.
Yeah.
Well, I'd come see you. I'd go all the way to New Orleans to see the singing bartender.
Well, thank you. That would be pretty delightful. I'm gonna talk to a couple of my friends and see if we can't make that happen. I'll let you know.
I knew a guy that used to deliver pizza, and to help get himself through college, and he sang when he delivered. He had this great voice, and his name was Aldo, and he was Italian. And he would deliver these pizzas and sing to the people he delivered them to. And it was, you know, he got a little bit of notoriety for being the singing pizza delivery guy.
That's perfect. I love that. And now I want to order a pizza. I really hope he delivers it.
So you got anything to tease us with in terms of any songs from the new album, or is there anything that you have that if the album was released today that was ready to go?
I don't have anything that is that ready to go. Nothing is mastered yet, but I have made a few live performance type videos on the YouTube channel for Daphne Lee Martin, and I will be putting little teasers up for the next, you know, 3-4 months on the Instagram and Facebook channels as well.
Are you able to change the YouTube to Daphne Parker Powell, or do you have to make a new one?
So that's been kind of an interesting question that I've been going through both with myself and with my my PR people, is trying to figure out the best path forward, because I have a beautiful body of work under the name Daphne Lee Martin, right? Yeah. I have 5 albums. Mm-hmm. And that was a period of my life that was extraordinary. And a part of me really wants to leave that intact as a sort of historic piece. Mm-hmm. And to start a new brand entirely with the new name. Not because my work isn't a continuation. It certainly is a continuation of me. But to just sort of create a delineation between what happened then and what is happening now, in a way. So I think largely, I've got 2 Instagram channels now, one which will become The Relic, and one which will become the new one. I have just switched over the Facebook at this point to Daphne Parker Pell. But I think what I'll probably will end up doing with the YouTube channel is starting a brand new one.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of like, it makes me think about, what's his name? John Cougar Mellencamp, John Mellencamp, John Cougar, John, who are you today?
Yeah.
But yeah. He survived.
He did, and he's brilliant. But he... You know, he also didn't, I guess, I don't know, it wasn't as big of a rebrand in a way.
Well, I guess, yeah.
A little bit different, but.
Well, all we have to connect him is Daphne. And so. And
that's true.
And you already.
And I mean, as far as sounds go, you had asked earlier about, like, how is this going to sound? Like, anybody that got the album Scared Fearless in 2018, you know, that was a pretty straight ahead Americana sounding record.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this one is going to lean into, it'll be a cleaner, crisper sound than a lot of the sort of Laurel Canyon 70s style albums, because just the technical production will be sparklier, if you will. But I think that what we're really very much leaning into with this record is a simple, spare sort of like a Joni Mitchell record.
Right.
Is what it's going to sound like. A lot of storytelling. The music is there to float the lyric.
Are all the stories autobiographical? Or any of them? Or are they?
So what I did in 2017... my divorce was final on April 3rd of 2017, which was 1 year, 1 day short of 10 years. Oh, man. Well, this just tells you how much I've let go. one day short of 10 years or 11 years of my relationship. And I was able to sort of set myself a daily routine, a goal of writing, pre-writing every day. And what I ended up doing was something called what I called the Summer of Song. So every day from basically June 20th until, you know, whatever day it was that summer ended that year, I wrote a new piece of lyric poetry every single day for that season. And published it on my Instagram, Facebook, all of the social media channels. And it was incredible. I ended up with 92 or 93 pieces by the end. And I've tried to replicate that pattern since, but I never quite got, you know, I was just so deep in the feeling of it at that time that I just went for it. And out of that, I ended up with, you know, probably 15 or 20 actually really decent, usable songs. And so that's what The Starter Wife sort of came out of, was culling that down, you know, to the most condensed, most, you know, potent.
Well, it seems like that material. Starter Wife title has been around for a while, because it seems like you were working on that when the pandemic hit, and that's why we don't have it yet.
Yes.
Is that right? Okay.
That's right. Yeah. I've already named the next album as well.
Oh.
You want to know what it is?
Yes, I do.
It's going to be The Death of Cool.
The Death of Cool. Okay.
Death of Cool.
Well, I'm intrigued already.
Yeah, I have about 7 of those songs written now as
well.
Wow.
So you could be one of those people that you got 6 or 7 in the flight path, circling the airport, you know, just waiting, waiting to...
Everybody's waiting for a landing strip, yeah. Yeah. It's funny because, you know, like I said, like most of The Starter Wife was written in 2017 and we're in 2022 now. Yeah, I should be writing another record, for crying out loud, you know?
Well, that's, yeah, that's...
I should be writing 2 more records. Ago.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and you got to... If you become one of those people that writes a does an album because of contractual obligation, you've just lost everything that made you you, isn't it? Because, right? I mean, if you're just doing it because I have to get paid, not that you shouldn't get paid, but some of the art has diminished, I would think.
I guess so. I think in a way I'm one of those people that would have been a good poster child for the contractual album thing because I just write so much anyway.
Well, if it's there, it's there. Right? And if it's there, it's there. And if it's good, fantastic. But if it's just done to get it done, just the way we used to do our homework, you know, all right, I'll write an answer.
You know, I actually have to thank you right now as well because when you and I were talking about doing this interview, you sent me a note about how your wife had spoken about the Preservation Hall.
Right.
Here in New Orleans, being held together by the mold. And for some reason, it struck me funny. Obviously, yes, I mean, a lot of people probably feel that way. The building itself, you know, has been through so many floods and hurricanes, and just, it's so historic, and it is kind of, it's decrepit, you know? But just that writing prompt, that trigger in my mind, allowed me this morning to sit with my coffee and just sort of let my brain escape my body for a little while and just float on that idea. And I ended up free writing, you know, like a 10-minute piece, all based on that thing that you had said. So thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome. I'm an accidental tool.
It's perfect.
And yeah, so yeah, it's so funny that she happened to say that because I don't know why we were talking about it. She and I went there together once, and to see all the she did a radio show for 8 years in San Diego on the jazz station there. She did a Dixieland and swing show for 8 years, and so she really. She lived in New Orleans a little bit as a little girl, and her, you know, her ancestry comes from Louisiana, and so she has an affinity for that, you know, traditional jazz thing. And so it was fun to get to go there and actually see it. It was nothing like I would have expected it to be.
What did you expect it to be?
Just more of a, I guess, more of a modern concert hall kind of place. You know, when you hear the term, preservation hall, you just think of, I don't know.
Almost like a college auditorium.
The Royal Albert Hall or something, you know. And so, and you walk.
Theater.
And like a theater. And you go in there and it's just like, oh my gosh. Don't touch anything, kids.
Yeah.
We were down there. We had our grandkids with us, and we went walking down Bourbon Street at night, and it was just, you know, it was full sleaze going on. And we were going,
oh, wow. Oh,
we shouldn't have brought these kids here. But they saw it.
Well, you just go a block down, you know, go to Royal. It's
well, we got... Well, actually, the time that, I don't know if that was the one. One of the times we went down there, because my wife used to take her mom down there when she couldn't travel by herself anymore. And when the airline started flying to Alaska, to New Orleans, we were able to go. Anyhow, we stayed. Oh, this was the first. They were just opening up after Katrina. Things were just coming back to life. And so there were a lot of good rates to be had in hotels and whatnot. So we were at this hotel, and I can't remember the name of it, but it used to be the Opera Hall. And it's at the corner of Toulouse and, what do you call it? We just said it. Bourbon and Toulouse. And it was, anyway, but it was really cool to get to stay there and look out, you know, on the old wrought iron balconies and stuff. It was pretty cool.
That's awesome.
So is there anything that we haven't talked about that you were hoping to talk about?
Oh, gosh. Life, the universe, and everything, right?
Well, you know, if you were going to sit there and you were imagining how this was going to go, you're going to say, oh, yeah, we'll talk about this.
Well, see, the most fantastic thing about being able to talk with you on one of these podcasts is that we've done it before.
Right.
And if I had my guess, we're probably going to do this again.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. In fact, well, I don't know. Well, hopefully, at the very latest, after Starter Wife comes out, we'll definitely have a chin wag.
I sure hope so.
And you know, I'm looking forward.
Come the fall,
I know. And I don't know. Then you can tour the album as the leaves are changing in Connecticut.
Yeah, that's true. In the meantime, I am planning on doing a run of shows in the Northeast in May, which is going to be a good time. I'm going to play at the Knickerbocker, which is an old favorite haunt of mine in Westerly, Rhode Island. I'm going to play at the State House in New Haven and the Stomping Ground in Putnam and several other shows up in the Northeast at the second and third weeks of May. So I'm going to almost celebrate my 40th birthday for the third time.